Okay, welcome back. Let's review where we were, okay? Because I hardly remember myself. I had somebody run here and get the notes this afternoon. Let's say you're a lady and you want to reach nirvana. Then what are the steps you have to go through? Because that's where we're going to pick up tonight. So I think... Which of the pratimoksha vows would you take first? Talking about a lady. If you're going to do it, in Tibetan it's called, I'll show you. Say nyeme, pinsol. Nyeme, pinsol. Okay. Nye means problem, bad thing. Nye. Me means no problem. Okay. Nyeme means like faultless or perfect. Okay. Nyeme. Nyeme means without a problem. Yeah, in the Bodhisattva vows, Anyeme is our dear friend, which is exceptions to the Bodhisattva vows. Like, in general, you commit it if you do that, but you can do this and still get away with it. Okay. But in Vinaya, Pratimoksha vows, it has a different meaning. So Anyeme means no problem. Punsol means like excellent, perfect. And Anyeme Punsol is a special expression in the Vinaya. And it refers to getting to your full ordination vows the right way. Like, just the right way. Okay? Like, if you can do it, like, not just the right way, or you can do it just the right way. Okay? And just the right way in Vinaya means going through the vows in order. Taking them in order. Technically, you can skip to a higher vow, or you can even take them in the same day I did. You know, you can take your novice vows and your full ordination vows in the same day, for example. That is recognized as a way to take the vows. It's not considered perfect. It's like, if you could go through them one by one and hang out in the vows for a while and take them gradually, then that's the ideal situation. So this really means ideal. Okay, this is the ideal way to take the vows. And we were talking about a woman, okay, who wants to take, let's say the woman wants to take full ordination, if it existed, okay, in the Tibetan tradition. So, let's say they want to take full ordination. Where would they start? Even before that. Okay, ideally, okay, this means ideal. You should take your Genyen Ma vows first, okay? So I'll write it up here. Genyen Ma is which vow, do you remember? Lifetime lay woman's vows, okay? Agreeing to keep for the whole length of your life, lay woman's vows. Okay. How many vows are there? Yeah. Okay. Which are? Do you remember? Yeah. Okay. No alcohol and no. Yeah. Okay. Those are the five. So really it's more or less like four basic ones. Well, I wouldn't say that. It's those five. Okay, so five vows. Although there are other versions of that vow, but that's the main one. Also to keep what? Something else. Yeah, keep the advices on going for refuge. Okay. I mean, that's an integral part. People don't count it when they count the vows, but it's really like half the vow is are you going to take refuge properly? Does that mean swearing? I mean, when I was growing up, frankly, as a Christian, and they said, thou shalt not have no other gods than me, and thou shalt not bow down to any graven image, or things like that. And then I carried that over into Buddhism. So I thought, if I'm taking refuge properly, I have to believe in a new statue. You know, like, I have to, when I take refuge, I have to think of this statue, instead of a crucifix. You know, like, I was thinking, well, I have to change statues, you know. And I mean, when you say take refuge in the Buddha, I'm afraid that's what comes up naturally in a person who grew up in the West. It's I have to do what I had to do when I was a kid, which is, I mean, I have to go to this place and I have to look at the thing on the altar and I have to put all my faith and trust in that statue. And I don't get anything out of that. That's always been a problem for me. You know, like, I could pray to this statue or not pray to this statue. My life pretty much went the same. So that's not what refuge is. I mean, and that's the advices on refuge. Refuge is a state of mind where you're putting all your hope and trust in what that being represents. And in the case of two of the three refuge objects, it's what? It involves seeing emptiness directly. Okay, you become Sangha refuge when you see emptiness directly. The ultimate Dharma refuge is to see emptiness directly. So the minute you see emptiness directly, you're already two of the three objects. You become what you would think was God or something. You know what I mean? You become the thing which everyone else is bowing to, and the thing that everyone else is taking refuge to, and you actually become that thing. Later on, when you reach Buddhahood, you become the first refuge object. So, I mean, when you think about a person who's committing themselves to a lifetime vow, think about that. You know, don't think, don't get fooled, don't bring that thing over from your childhood where you're taking refuge in a picture. I mean, Buddha doesn't have to look like that at all. We studied that in California. That's the Chokitoku, that's the ultimate Nirmanakaya. That's the ultimate way they show themselves in the world. But they don't gotta look like that at all. They could be anybody. Don't put the Buddhas down. Don't think they can't look like anything. They can look like anything. They could look like anybody around you. That's not the point. The point is not how they look. The point is how they think and what they do. And that's what you're taking refuge in. It's not. So I think it's really important when you talk about taking Ganyan vows, lifetime layman's vows, that you're taking the state of refuge in your mind and you're putting your hopes in something spiritual. You're putting your hopes, for example, in an ethical way of living. And that's your refuge. You're not taking refuge so much in some divine being or something like that. I mean, it's part of it, but it's not the main thing. The main thing is to understand emptiness, understand why you need to live an ethical way of living, and that's refuge. And that be why? I almost said it for you. Why? Why is that refuge? It protects you. You know, if you don't like the way life is going, then take refuge, because it protects you. Simply bowing in front of a picture of an Asian-looking person instead of a Middle Eastern-looking person who's come to look like an English person is not going to protect you. It won't protect you. I mean, maybe there's some small virtue, but it won't protect you like keeping your vows. Keeping your vows really protects you. Keeping that way of life really protects you. That's protection. And think about that as, when you think of Ganyan, when you think of lifetime vows, really the whole point is that you got both halves. You're taking refuge, and you're committing yourself to the actions which are protection. And they go together. That's why they go together. And that's taking Ganyan vows. So if you're going to do it ideally, in the ideal way, if you're going to become a fully ordained nun, in the ideal way, you would first take Ganyan monk. What would you take after that? Very close. No cigar. It's a trick question. That's a novice nun, but we're missing something. You have to do something between there. Do you remember? Yeah, to vow. It's not really a vow, and it doesn't count as a pratimoksha vow, but it's a commitment to leave the home life. It's called Parma Rabchu. Say Parma Rabchu. Parma Rabchu. It's not one of the, how many pratimoksha vows? Sets of vows, I should say. Eight. There's eight sets of vows, right? This doesn't count as one of the eight, but it is a commitment that you have to make before you take the next step up. Okay? If you're going to be ordained, you first have to take Parma Rabchu. Parma Rabchu means I agree to leave the home life. I'm not going to try to do the family life thing anymore. Okay? Then you take Getsul Ma. And Getsul and Getsul Ma, in its most basic form, has how many vows? Do you remember? You can say 13. Sometimes they say 10, they leave out the last three. So that would be 5 and 5, or 3 and 7, or what? 4 and 6. Oh, you guys are cool. Okay. 4 plus 6. In its most basic form, I mean, you can divide it into, there's also division into 36, and there's another division into 40, and there's a division into 13. But we're going to talk 10. What are the four? But where do these four come from? Yeah, they actually come from the one-day vows. I mean, they match the one-day vows. Yeah, because you're pledging to be celibate, right? So this is the root four as expressed in the one-day vows. No killing anything, really. No stealing over a certain amount. No sexual misconduct. No lying. Okay. And then six, which is what? Where do these six come from? Of the one-day vow. Okay, these come from the one-day vow. But you split one of the one-day vows into two, which is what? Karsaltasana. Yeah, dancing, etc., and ornaments, etc., split into two, which I... And then dealing with mula. Okay? All right? And that makes 10. Which brings us up to this class that we're in tonight. Okay? The reason we talked about a woman in particular is that there's an intermediate ordained vow that only women take. Men don't have to take. Okay? And it's called a gelobma. So it's going something like this. Gelobma is a getsoma with 12 more vows. So it's the 10, those 10, basically, okay, plus 12. To be geloma means intermediate nun. Okay, it's before you reach your full nun's vows. Those 12 are divided into two sets of 6. Okay, say tsawe, chudu, tsawe, chudu. Tsawa means root or primary. Tsawa means primary. Chu means things. Okay, things. It means dharma, right? Here it means things. It means things that you agree to stop doing, right? I mean, that's what it means here. And then druk means 6, number 6. And this is 5 activities that an intermediate nun agrees to stop, to give up. Okay? I can't tell you what they are. You can't learn them until you become ordained. They are in the root text and they're in the commentary. And you're going to get the reading tonight, but when you get to that part, it'll have dot, dot, dot. Okay? I don't think we can publish it. So, I can't tell you much more about it. They have to do with, a lot of, like getting into situations where you would be in intimate contact with a man, for example. That's the kind of vows that are there. That's Sari Chudu. Jetun we've translated as ancillary vows or secondary vows, okay? Chuduk is the same, 6 things which you have to give up. I can't, again, describe them to you in detail, but these mostly relate to activities that would be improper. For example, how you store food, whether or not you store food, whether you can eat food which has not been blessed properly, things like that. I can't go into much detail with it. So these are more serious, the first 6, and the secondaries are less serious. Have to do with digging in the ground, for example, which hurts insects and stuff like that. Okay, those are, you know, very roughly examples. I can't go into much detail, but it's things that would be improper behavior for a person who's about to become a nun, a full nun, okay? Excuse me?
Again, you don't know them before you take
them. I think in most cases a responsible lama, if he knew that you were about to commit yourself to them, he or she would describe them to you in detail before you took them. I think practically they do that. Somebody asked me in the Tibetan class, so what's the problem with knowing them? And I promised to ask Rinpoche and I haven't done it yet. Okay, I don't exactly know why. I know that, for example, you cannot give a pratimoksha vow to someone who is just wants to check out what that's, you know, who's from another tradition and more or less just wants to figure out what's going on in Buddhism. And it's not because they have renunciation. It's because they're somehow curious or they want to incorporate some of it into their spiritual path or something like that. And you're not allowed to give pratimoksha vows to somebody who is not committed to getting out of samsara and who doesn't understand what samsara is to get out of. What is samsara? I mean, in its most basic form, the reason you're taking these vows is to get to nirvana. Nirvana is the permanent cessation of your mental afflictions. So, I mean, mainly, you have to be tired of being unhappy. That's very interesting. You know, I mean, the reason to take pratimoksha vows mainly is that you're tired of your own mind being bad. It's interesting, because if you define pratimoksha vows as something you take in order to get into nirvana, nirvana is the absence of those bad thoughts. So really, what you're committing yourself to is to keeping a code of behavior in order not to be unhappy anymore. Okay? And if you take them for any other reason, like, let's see what this guy's do that we could incorporate into our new latest book about something, you know, then that's an improper motivation, and we're not allowed to give pratimoksha vows to such a person, and they don't actually form. They can sit through the ceremony, they can be listening, they can be repeating all the words properly, but if they don't really, if they're not fed up with being unhappy, if they don't want to get rid of the mental afflictions, then they can't take vows. There's no reason to take vows. The purpose of taking vows is to get rid of your mental afflictions, primarily. Secondarily, you will get rid of your other kinds of suffering, like your physical suffering, the fact of getting aging, old, like that. Yeah, I can't hear you. Oh, they are. No, I didn't mean it like only women, but I'm just doing a woman's case today at the beginning because they're required to take a special pre-full ordination vow. I've heard a Dharma rumor, which I don't want to repeat because I have not seen it confirmed in the scripture. So I actually won't repeat it because then people will think of it that way. I believe that... I'll repeat the Dharma rumor. I've not seen it in a scripture and I haven't had it explained to me, but I've heard this from some people. By the way, this vow is kept for 2 years only. Okay, it's a 2 year commitment. You pledge to keep those 12 for 2 years. I've heard, I don't know if it's true, that it might apply especially to women who are pregnant and don't know it when they take this vow, and then if they had taken full nun's vows, it would look very strange after 9 months or something. So they pledge to keep this vow you can take a Geitsul Ma and a Gelo Ma very quickly after each other. So if you were already pregnant and you didn't know it, and then you took your full nun's vows, and then after a certain time they saw nuns walking around with big tummies, people might think badly. So I've heard that. It makes sense knowing that the vow lasts for 2 years only, that you only commit yourself for 2 years. But I haven't confirmed that. Okay, I'll try to confirm that before the end of the course. I have not seen that mentioned in this text I've studied, but I have not studied it deeply. Okay.
Real quick, I mean, that's all part of a huge can of worms, escape suffering part of capitalism in the whole
day-to-day. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Mental suffering.
If you study sociology, it's like the whole your psyche is formed by the means of production.
No, you can go through, I mean, the Dalai Lama was the single wealthiest person in Tibet and had pretty much total authority over every part of Tibet. And to be a king is not like to be a president. A president has to follow the laws. A king in the old sense of the way owns everything in the country. They can come to your house and say, I want your car, and you have to give them your car. You know, I mean, that's a king. And they say that the Dalai Lama, while he was overseeing this country of 6 million people, 5,000 monasteries, you know, obviously extremely busy, and all they cared... The only possessions they felt they owned. There's a famous quotation by one of the Dalai Lamas. The only thing in my mind that I own is my bell and my dorje. You know, those are the only two things I own. Those are the only two things I care about to own. And I don't feel like the rest is mine. You know, they had the Potala Palace. It has, I don't know, 500 rooms or something. And they didn't feel... I mean, it's possible. The goal is to reach a state where your mind is totally clean. And totally, it's a very interesting concept. It would be like some kind of a golden window or something. And if you got there, if your mind got there, you would never again be upset at work. You would never again be unhappy. You would never again be nervous or irritated. You would just be totally, your mind would be totally clean throughout. That can only be done by seeing emptiness directly. There is no other way. And it's not like an instant result of seeing emptiness directly. It's the result of a long period of practice in the world after you see emptiness directly. And we studied that a lot. It's a long story. But you must see emptiness directly, and then you must apply that understanding for a long period of time, and then you can reach that place. But you would be, and at that point your body hasn't changed. It comes later. That comes later. So really you still have a piece of samsara left over. They call it bhakche. It's a piece left over. There's still parts of you which are suffering, but your mind is not suffering. And you can do that. And that would be a really wonderful thing to take to work. You know, I mean, it would be very unusual to have a person at work under the pressure of a normal office, under the normal stresses and screaming people and demands on your morality. You know, could you just lie a little bit today? We need this deal closed, you know. To keep it in those conditions is really, you haven't reached nirvana if you can't keep it in those conditions. So it'd be good to be in those conditions. Because then you know if you got there or not. I mean, if you're going to sit in a cave and not get angry at anybody, so big deal. You know. Well, there's a point at which you should be in a cave. Okay. And then you should come out and go to the office. You know. And probably you have to go back a few times, like many times. You need both. You really do need both. And people should do both. At least a couple times a year you should go work on it in meditation and then bring it back. Okay? That's Gelobma. Those two sets of vows. Yeah. We're going to talk about it right now, Sabuti. She asked, who can give you these vows? There's a thing like this. I got to make sure I spell it right. Yulu and Takop. Takop. This is another, there's a lot of unique Vinaya expressions. And I, you know, we'll go through a few of them. Yulu means a central land, okay? Middle kingdom, a civilized country. Yul means country, U means central, okay, a central land. What's called a civilized country from a Buddhist point of view, okay? And Takop refers to a uncivilized country, a barbarian land from a Buddhist point of view. Takop means outlying land, an outlying land. Yulu means a place where the Buddhism is firmly established. And Takop means a place where it's not established firmly. And there's all these arguments about exactly what means firmly, and you know, as you can imagine, the Vinaya has hundreds of pages about what is a yul, what makes a yulu. Very roughly, you can, in general, consider a country a Buddhist country once the Sangha are performing sojong on a regular basis. Okay, I mean, a country is considered a Buddhist country once there is a Sangha, meaning four or five fully ordained people holding sojong, holding the confession ceremony on a regular basis, twice a month. Then you can say Buddhism has reached that country. So, as far as I know, it's being done only definitely in New Jersey. And I believe there's a group now in Maryland that's doing it. So you can call maybe the Eastern Seaboard a Buddhist country. Yulu means firmly established, though. And Takop means, okay, Buddhist country, but not firmly established. In a Yulu, to make a Gelobma, you must have a quorum of 12 Gelongmas, 12 fully ordained monks, nuns, must be present for that ceremony. Okay, 12. No, to make a Gelobma, to make an intermediate nun, it takes 12 Gelongmas, fully ordained nuns. The requirements for the abbess are especially stringent, and it would probably be difficult to find someone who had perfect all the requirements. They're very difficult to have. I mean, they require keeping your vows for a very long time, not having broken major ones. It's very strict to be a real abbess, meaning the mistress of the ceremony, right? Mistress of the ceremony, okay? I mean, to be the one who directs the ceremony, the nun, it's very difficult. in an outlying land, 6 gelomas is enough. Okay, 6 gelomas. So normally the ceremony is presided over by a nun, a fully ordained nun. Normally, there are certain requirements as far as the woman's dress. She has to have 2 of the 3 standard robes. There are 3 standard robes that you have to have. Before, as she takes the vow, she has to possess. She already has to have those 2 robes ready. She has to have a begging bowl. Okay, she has to have all the requirements of a fully ordained person, except for one of the outer robes. She has to have 2 of the 3 robes. And she has to have taken Geitsulma before. Okay, she has to have taken this vow before. Now, whether it was done in the extended way of going through each and keeping each for a while, which is the ideal way to do it, is not, that's the best way to do it. But in either case, even if she takes her Geloma vow the same day that she takes her novice nun vow, she must take the novice nun's vow first. She must take this first. And then she has to do a certain ceremony of requesting her vows from the full nun who gives the vows. And that's called a ceremony of a double request. Okay. When you do the higher vows, it's a different ceremony. Okay. So it's called the double request. And then she can become a Geloma. Can she then become a Geloma? Bhikshuni. Okay, Bhikshuni, a fully ordained nun. And we're going to talk about that after the break. But there's one step that this lady, this intermediate nun, has to go through before she can take a Geloma. And that's, is that another vow? Is that another Pratimoksha vow? No, there ain't no more female Pratimoksha vows than these and the one-day lady's vow, right? So it's not another Pratimoksha vow. It's another commitment that she has to make. It's a little bit similar to this number 2 here, which is not a vow, but it's a commitment. She has to make another commitment at the end of the 2 years. And it's called Nyerneki Tsutim. Tsangchu Nyerneki Tsutim. Tsang means pure. Brahma in Sanskrit. Okay, Tsang means pure. Chu means activity. Generally speaking, Sangwarchupa means to observe celibacy. Okay? To observe celibacy. Sangcha. Nirne means to keep it especially well. Okay? Nirne. And Sutim means morality. Sometimes they call it a domba, which is a vow. But then the other texts say, look, it's not a real vow. So you're going to confuse people if you call it a vow. So let's call it a way of living where you commit yourself to a particular level of pure activity. Now, I've never seen yet a good explanation of what this entails. And in Tibet, you can't take this vow anymore anyway. You can't take a Geloma, and you can't take a Tsangcha vow. The lineage has been broken in Tibet. So they don't cover it a whole lot, except in theory, okay? What's that? There's Dharma rumors. I mean, there may be a still authentic transmission of the full nun's vows in other countries. Like some people have said, Taiwan, maybe Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Vietnam. But we haven't been able to confirm it yet. Okay, I mean, His Holiness is studying it, okay? We haven't been able to confirm it yet. I had a very aggressive Californian nun ask me, well, just how would you confirm it? And I said, that's His Holiness's job, not my job. And then they said, well, you're teaching Buddhism, you better figure it out, you know? And I said, well, if it were me, which it's not, I would go observe the ceremony and see if it's authentic. You know, are there 12 fully ordained nuns there if it's a central land? If it's not, are there six fully ordained nuns there? Does the current abbess have all the qualifications of an abbess? Because even if the tradition had been authentic up to the present time, if they weren't doing it that way now, it's broken. In as far as I understand it, which is, Rinpoche always says that's not very far. That would be my first. Then I would try to establish whether or not that had always been done that way. Because if it had not, if is there ever a 20-year period where it had not been done that way, I believe you would say that the transmission was broken. Now, how do you prove that? I mean, you'd go back and try to study records of ordinations and things like that. That's all I can think of. I don't know of any other. I guess you would want to look at the vows and see if they, you know. We see there are certain kinds of customs that have sprung up in countries like Thailand of taking a lifetime vow for 3 months. And we don't recognize that. I mean, that's not in the 8 Pratimoksha vows. Is it useful? I think it may be very useful. Is it a Pratimoksha vow? I don't believe so. I've never seen that in the Pratimoksha vows. I don't believe it's in the Vinaya. But so you have to check it out. Things have to be pure. Yeah. No, you need 12 of these to make this. That's a problem. No, it takes 12 of number 6 to make one number 4. You see what I mean? If there's not 12 of number 6 around in the world, you can't, in a central land, you can't make any more new nuns. Right. Yeah. A monk, for example, can give these vows, and a Geshe Lama can give these vows. You know, I believe in extraordinary cases, a monk may be able to give these vows, but I don't want to, don't quote me, okay? But I don't believe you can give these vows except through a very difficult ceremony with a very stringent number of nuns and things like that. Okay, yeah. 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 Right. There's a thing called a Lunchok and a Darchok. Okay? Tatawe Choga and a Lungi Choga. Lungi Choga means, I mean, there's a debate that comes up in the Vinaya at this very point in the scripture. And it says, could you become a, you know, that's interesting. Anyway, could you become a full, let me think how it goes. Actually, I wrote it down. Let me make sure I get it straight. Lancho means in the first five, did we go over that? In the first 5 years of the Buddha's teaching, monks and nuns were made by about 12 different methods, including the Buddha saying, Vilma, come. Come to me. And then your hair would fall off and your clothes would change into a nun's clothes and Ken would be upset at me. No. that's one way. And there's like, by letter, the Buddha sent a letter to someone and said, you know, you're a nun now. I said, that was the ordination. And like that. And that's recognized as a real ordination. After 5 years of the Buddha's teaching, he changed, and he said, from now on, it has to be like this. There has to be 12 nuns in a central land. There has to be 6 nuns in an outlying land. And he made rules that if there weren't that, it would not be a transmission of the blessing of the vows. And that's all I don't know much more than that. We're going to be studying it. We'll get back to you in about 6 years. There's things called lay. There's things called legi choga. Legi choga means a real Vinaya activity. And there is 100 or 100 and something. For monks, for example. In many of those activities, there has to be a quorum present. You know, why was it that way? I don't, you know, I could go check in a scripture, but I think mainly it's that you're making a very serious commitment, and perhaps that there should be enough people present to witness that commitment. You know, I've heard that some kinds of weddings are like that. You know, if they make it a big deal in some traditions, because you'll be afraid to get divorced after that. You know, because like 400 people were invited. You know, and you would be embarrassed. I think that's part of the point, is that there would be enough people around you in your immediate life. 12 people were present when you took those vows. Like, I remember the people who were present when I took my vows. And when I'm around them, I feel especially responsible to keep them. So it may be that thing like in the Bodhisattva vows where being embarrassed to break them in front of the people you took them from plays a large role in keeping them well. But I haven't seen exactly it stated directly. There are scriptures which I'm sure state it, but I haven't studied them yet. Is there any way, other way, to become a full nun in the present day, according to... Okay, let's skip those first 5 years of the Buddhist teaching. Is there any other way to become a full nun in the present day, aside from going either through these as a slow process, which is ideal, or going through them in sort of a, you know, doing the two of them in one day and stuff like that, which is okay, which is allowed. You do get your vows. Is there any other way to become a full nun? And that just gave me an idea about restoring the nun's vows. If a full monk changes sexes, he becomes a full nun. She becomes a full nun. Okay. They become a full nun. Okay. So maybe if you could find 12 guys willing to... Yeah, oh yeah. No, there are cases in the ancient history when... I know. Apparently in the old days, there was be something that could happen halfway through your life where your sex actually changes naturally. I don't believe it referred to an artificial sex change, but I'm not sure about that. But it was where actually what we call the sexual energy, which is called mo-wa-mo or po-wa-mo, it actually changes into, you become a woman. I can't say much more about that, but it's recognized in scripture that, and in ancient times apparently it was not uncommon, because it's mentioned a lot, that it's possible for the sex to change halfway through your life. And in fact it can happen more than once, and as we're going to study in the next class, if it happens more than 3 times, you lose your vows. Okay. Or if it happens 3 times, let's assume you're... Okay? It happened. Well, I mean more than twice. How's that? 3 times or more. Nensumgyur. Okay? So I guess in theory, if you had 12 monks, fully ordained monks, that happened to, they could restore the... I didn't think about that. But that's another way to get to Gelongma without going through this. So there's only 2 ways. And that's why I brought it up. You can either live in the first 5 years of the Buddhist teaching, or you can be a fully ordained monk who becomes a fully ordained nun by changing sex. And sex has a lot to do with the vows, and the sexual energy has a lot to do with the vows. And we'll talk a little bit about it next time. What happens to a gelongma if she changes sexes? See, there's no gelopa. There's no male version of this. So she becomes a geitsu. She becomes a geitsu. Okay. And for that reason, when they group the vows by type, what's called ze, this gelobma is included into the geitsu and the geitsuma vows. So although there are 8 separate groups of pratimoksha vows, by type, there's a thing called essence or essential nature. And that... When you divide these by ze, that gelob ma vow would be actually grouped with the geitsu and the geitsu ma. So those three would be grouped together as being of the same general type. Okay, Perello, don't worry about it. Oh, it must happen a lot because it comes in the script. Apparently in ancient India, for some reason or another, it must have happened a lot because even physically, the change happening. It was been described in the scriptures. They're also like, if you want to get into it, five kinds of male neuters, five kinds of female neuters, hermaphrodites, and anyway, we're going to get into that. We're going to get into that next week. In other words, there's something about the pure sexual energy of a male or a female which helps the vowels to grow. That we don't believe, for example, that a person who doesn't have that energy can keep vowels, because according to the scriptures, it affects the stability of their minds. Apparently, to have all your hormones intact actually literally makes has an effect on your mind. And people who don't, like people who have been neuterized or something like that, they can't take vowels. There's something that happens about the lack of a sexual energy means their minds are not as stable or as strong-minded, strong-willed. Their willpower is somehow affected. And they can't keep... They're not an appropriate physical body to take vows. And that also applies to higher teachings. You have to have that. That has a real downside in that it can be abused so much, the sexual energy. But it has an upside that it gives you a tremendous strength, and you can use it for very good things if you use it properly, and you'd need it for certain kinds of teachings. Okay, we'll take a break, and then we'll cover full nuns and full monks vows in absolutely no detail. But I wanted you to get a taste of how the vows build on each other, and I think you've got you got some taste for that, how they're building on each other. Okay, Gelong Ma. Or a Gelong. For Gelong, you just cut this out, okay? But we're going to start with a Gelong Ma. And I can't tell you much about these vows because I'm not supposed to. And I was even hesitant to have a course called Vinaya because it would get around to the monks in the world and nuns that I was teaching Vinaya to non-ordained people, and I'd get in trouble. But I can tell you some general things. And that's what I'm going to do. Say, Tungwa, Denga. Tungwa, Denga. Tungwa means, and Tungwa is the same as Lungwa. And they both mean to trip or fall down. You can call them falls. Tungwa. De means a group. And Nga means five. The five groups of falls. Fall means here breaking a vow. Okay? And there are five groups into which the nun's vows and the monk's vows fall. Okay? And I'm going to give you the names of the five groups and describe them very briefly, but nothing precise. Okay? Say Pamba. Pamba. Pam means to lose. Like if you have a football game and you lose, that's Pamba. Okay? Pamba means to be defeated. This is the most serious group of vows. Most serious group of falls. Okay? And Pamba Geda. A nun, a full nun, has eight of these. There's a nice section in the reading that you'll see that I left in there that explains why they are called defeats. I translate them as defeats. There are eight defeats. And in all the Vinaya scriptures I've seen, they're called defeats because your mental afflictions defeat you. Okay, if you commit one of these, it's normally because your mental afflictions have defeated you. And then obviously they're also going to promote your mental afflictions very badly. These vows damage, these falls damage the vows very, very seriously. And in fact, some groups of Buddhists, although not the one that we follow, some schools of ancient India believed that if you committed one of these, you lose your vows completely. You lose all your vows. Okay? So these were very serious. We're going to talk about that next time. Our particular school that we belong to in Vinaya does not believe that. But these are so serious that there have been groups of Buddhist schools of ancient India that said, if you commit one of these eight, you lose all your vows altogether. Okay. even in our school, they are damaged very, very badly, like irreparably damaged. I'll tell you that for a full monk, they pretty much correspond to the root four. Make sense? I mean, the most serious forms of those four indicate the four of a Geto, right? Okay, the root four of a Geto pretty much correspond to that. I don't know, in fact, in the case of these eight. I assume they include those four and then maybe four others. Okay. But I couldn't tell you if I knew. Phagma means remainder. Okay? Literally means remainder. What's the favorite Tibetan soup of all time? Tibetan soup. In Tibetan. Tukpa. Okay? And what's leftover tukpa is called tuklak. So you get a sense of what phag means. Phagche nirvana is what? Phagche, where you still have phagma. That's that point where your mind is totally pure, but you still have the suffering body. Okay? And then when you get rid of the suffering body, that's phagme. No more phagma. So you get a sense of what phagma means. Phagma means a leftover. How come there's no thing called a mokhlak? Mokhlak. What's mok? And slurred in modern Tibetan is momo. Tibetan dumplings, right? Like, you never hear that there's mokhlak for dinner, because they always eat all of them. Because they love them. This is a national food. There's no such word that I've ever heard anybody say mohat, which is leftover momos. But there's always tuhat, leftover tupa. Like, what are you having for dinner? They say tuhat. Everybody goes, not tuhat again, you know. Leftover tupa. So hama means remainder. Pamage hama nishudang. 20. What's the difference between a hagma and a pamba? A phagma is more serious, less serious than a pamba, and more serious than the next one. And that's it. That's all it says. The literal meaning of phagma, phagpa, phagma, is that you still have something left over that you could repair and get the vowel back to just about normal. Which implies that with a pamba, it's got some kind of irreparable damage. And then the text always says, but don't take these words too literally. Okay, I mean, they have their own flavors of what they mean in general, but you're going to see that they are not, these literal explanations are not like airtight. They're not like what's the Tibetan word for nirvana? Nyangen le depa, nyangde. Transcending all grief. Now, do you transcend all grief if you reach nyangde? Well, you do, but is it just the kind of grief of losing your mother or something like that? No. So in some cases, the words in Buddhism are not totally descriptive. They're just a general word that sounds like that thing. So these are generally descriptive words, but they're not airtight definitions or anything like that. The definition of a lhagma is that member in the five groups which is less serious than the one before and more serious than the next one. And that's all. You could have called it serious level number one, serious level number two, serious level number three, okay? Hama, tung, say tungje. Tungje. Tung means what? To fall. Okay? Je means makes you fall. Okay? We translate it as downfall, which is not the same as the general name for all of these things, which is called tungwa. So don't confuse them. Tungwa means a fall. Tungje means a downfall. We're trying to distinguish between the two. And it's called a downfall because if you commit one of these, it takes you to the lower realms. It makes you fall down to the lower realms. Well, is it not the case that these two do the same thing? Sure. So again, the word is not exclusive. It's just meant, they're trying to give you a flavor of what it means. Okay. Tungje. There's two types of tungjes. They are normally split into two groups. Okay. Two kinds of tungjes. Two kinds of downfalls. Say pangtung. Pangtung. Pang means to give up something. Pang means to give up something. Tung stands for tungje, meaning a downfall. So pangtung means a downfall where you have to, it's called release something. You have to give up something. And these are a certain group of vows where in order to fix what you did, you have to give up something for a certain period of time. Okay. For example, if you've kept a possession longer than allowed by the Vinaya. You in the Vinaya, in the strict Vinaya, which would be very cool to live that way, you don't have any possessions, basically. You own your robes, you own your bowl, you own your strainer, which you strain the water with so you don't kill bugs, and you might own a parasol so you don't burn your bald head. But you don't have much, you're not even allowed to own much more than that. If you do happen to, let's say, get some cloth, with the intention of making them into robes, because your old robes have all worn out and you threw them away or something, and you keep the cloth too long without making it into a robe, which means now you're getting possessive about the cloth, right? It was kind of pretty and you wanted to have it. And to purify yourself, you have to separate yourself from that cloth. You have to give up that cloth before you, as you do the act of confession. So there's, I think it's 33, let me see. A nun has 33 of these, a full nun, where she has to give up something in order to fix them. Okay. Bashik. Dungje. Bashik. Dungje means a downfall, and Bashik means a simple downfall, implying that you don't have to go through giving up something to fix it. Okay. So there's two kinds of downfalls. Bangtung means fixing this breaking of the vow requires giving up something. These don't, but they are both types of downfalls. They both belong to group number 3. On your homework, it's going to say, give the 6 groups. So what are you going to do? You're going to split this into 2 groups. Okay, this is going to be 3A and 3B, and you're going to come out with 6. Okay, although generally there's only 5 groups. Bashik means simple. Bashik means you don't have to give up anything. You don't have to take back anything or give back anything or leave something. Bashik means a simple downfall, okay? Which implies you don't have to give up anything. For example, the cloth that you've kept too long because actually you like it and you're attached to the cloth. I mean, pure Vinaya, you don't own anything and you don't need anything and you have no desires for anything. And that's the bottom line of a monk's life, ideally. There are lots of mix-ups. So in a special situation, you're allowed to keep the cloth. If you take bodhisattva vows, you are required, if offered 25 warehouses of cloth, to keep them, get a hold of them, acquire them, negotiate them, protect them, get them into shipping containers and ship them somewhere where they'll be of use to somebody. You are required. That overrides this. If you're a monk and you have bodhisattva vows, the whole scene changes a lot. You're required to store cloth. And you're required to have possessions if they're of use to other people. If by having possessions you can serve other people, you're required to have them. Okay? I mean, it'd be easier not to have them. But as a bodhisattva monk, you're required to have them in order to serve other people. Okay? So the flavor changes a lot. Dungje Bashik, how many they have? 90. What differentiates a Dungje from a Lhagma? What makes a bad deed in group number 3 different from the bad deed in group number 2? Just less serious, okay? It's less serious than 2, but more serious than 4. Okay? I haven't seen anything that said that. Okay. That doesn't mean it's not there. It's a good question. I don't think so. I think the distinction between these two is only whether or not you have to give up something as part of it.
I'm just wondering if that implies
it. I don't think it does. Not that I'm aware of. Could be wrong. This is not 90, it's 180. Say Soshat. Soshat? Okay, Soshat we have 11. Why is it... Why are these 11 put into a separate group? No brainer, please. They're less serious than number 3. They're more serious than number 5. Okay, and that's the only thing that makes them different. Okay, literally, sor shak means sor shakpa. Sor means individually. Shak means to confess. You can say bad deeds or breaking a vow that you have to confess individually. And, you know, they say a monk or a nun, a full monk especially, during the sojo ceremony, at some point, it has to confess these one by one. But that's also true of the other, you know. So, it's really just another word for breaking a vow. And it's just to indicate that these are much less serious than these. By the way, once you get down to this number 4 and 5, they get pretty minor. And you, when you study them, you'll see that. I mean, it's not like, these are not big, big, major breakings of vows, okay? They're all physical and verbal, don't forget, mostly. Okay, almost always they are. They're like, you know, you were, I don't want to get into it. But for example, taking food from certain improper people would be a sosa shashi. Okay. number 5. Nye means bad. Say nyeje. Nyeje. I'm putting a mental seed in your mind so that when you become ordained in this life or the next, it'll be easier to memorize the sojo ceremony. Right? Okay. Say nyeje. Nyeje. It seems to be some kind of obstacle with the sojo ceremony. We're not supposed to take a paper in there. Nobody. And it seems to be hard for us to memorize. We're always sweating over it. Rinpoche is always tormenting us. But anyway, nyeje means did a bad thing. Nye means bad, che means did. And it just means doing something wrong. Okay. And the literal explanation is lekpa mayimba chepa, which means you did something which was not excellent. Okay. Okay. Which is not good. And there's 112 of those. So how many vows does a fully ordained nun have in this tradition? Does it add up? Did you get 364? Really? I must have messed up someplace. 364? That's good. Okay? That's a gelong, yes?
Are you allowed to know all of their vows?
Yeah. Because a monk can teach the Vinaya to gelong mas. Don't get me into it, okay? I'm very good at sidestepping this issue. Okay. Our class is just about done. I'm going to give you the number for the monks, okay? The monks' groups are still 5. Or 6 if you split number 3 into 2. And I'll just give you the number of vows, okay? I'll circle the monks' ones. 4 pambas, 4 defeats. Plagma, which means a little bit left to fix, 13. Downfalls, where you have to give up something, 30 of those. Downfalls where you don't have to give up something, 90. It's easier to be a monk, right? I wonder why there's exactly double. There's probably something going on there. Okay. Sosa Sharpa, only 4.
If you're a woman and you're a lawyer, you're more.
Careful. And 112, same. So how many do you have for a monk? Yeah. Nigyang up to Tsasu Nampo, that's the root text, 253. Okay. Excuse me? Four. Instead of 11. Okay, so you should come out with 253. Okay. Did you have a question? I'll tell you frankly, because it's a, I feel kind of strongly about it. The wording of the sojong ceremony makes you believe that originally the monks sat around and actually said what they did. Because there's a section in near the end where it says, are we done? Did everybody say everything they did? You know, and I'm asking you once, I'm asking you twice, think about it, I'm asking you 3 times. If you don't speak up, then you're lying. And a hidden breaking a vow and hiding it is much more serious than breaking a vow and not hiding it. There's 2 kinds. So the wording of the ceremony makes me think that originally people actually sat down and you know, said what they did. In the current ceremony, as it's practiced in Tibetan, Gelugpa Tibetan, Sarame Monastery. By the way, the both Saras do their confession together. So it's one activity that the two Saras join and do together. You just go straight through it. and you just recite it. And you know, I believe that the serious monks there are mentally reviewing the vows, and I think mentally they are confessing what they did. And I know that some of them actually go to other monks and tell them what they did. And you should. No matter what kind of vows you have, it's much more powerful if you actually go to somebody. And the only requirement in the Bodhisattva vows, for example, is that they understand how serious they are. They don't even have to have Bodhisattva vows, I think. They have to understand the concept and know how serious it is. But you do... It's much more powerful if you go and confess it. And I encourage everybody to do it. It's very, very liberating, and it's very, very cool. And I've had times when I couldn't stop a bad habit, and I said, if I do this one more time, I'm going to go tell Rinpoche to his face. Clearly, you know. And I did. And it was very embarrassing, and it works. I mean, it's very embarrassing to admit it in front of other people. I mean, it's good to find someone who's such a good person that it would be very embarrassing for you to go and tell them. I've had monks, you know, say, don't tell me, don't tell me. You know, because Rinpoche wasn't around. But there's a time factor. The quicker you confess it, the better it is. If you let it go on for a day or two, one thing, you could die in there. And then secondly, it's just the power of the bad deed, like supposedly doubles every 24 hours or something. So it's important to tell it to somebody quickly. And it's very, very liberating. Even if you can't stop yourself, and even if you know you're going to be doing it over and over again, go tell somebody. Because just telling purifies a lot of the bad deed. You know? So it's very cool. And is this some kind of thing like back in confirmation class and stuff like that? I don't know what you did in church, you know. But, I mean, is it some kind of guilt thing? Or are you supposed to feel bad, or... are you supposed to feel dirty or guilty or something? No, it's not like that. If you really have a nice relationship with a lama, if you really find your root lama, you know, all they want is that you're happy. And you can't be happy if you're doing these things. You just never will be. Forget reaching nirvana. You won't even be happy in this life. You just won't feel clean. And you know that. You don't have to be Einstein to know that when you do something bad, you feel dirty. You just feel dirty. If you do any one of those main ones, you don't have to be a Buddhist to feel bad about it. I mean, normally most people feel bad about it. And you won't be able to go on spiritually. I have a lot of Americans come to me and say, my meditation is not going well. I'm doing this tantric stuff all day long. I do the whole ritual. I do everything they told me to do. And I've been doing it for 10 years and nothing's happening much. And I'm losing faith in it. You know, what should I do? You know, and I believe that in a lot of cases it's that they're not keeping an ethical way of life. And it's very tricky. You know, like idle gossip. You can be in Buddhist groups and you can be driving in a car with a bunch of Buddhists and you never heard so much idle gossip. I mean, it's relentless. I mean, you can get a headache from that. And then they go and do their prayers. They're on their way to do a prayer. And they're like doing this idle gossip. It's driving you, it's giving you a headache. And then when you get there, they do their prayers and they do their meditations and they say, I can't figure out why this is not working, you know. Like, I'm doing the posture perfect. I can do a full lotus. You know, I can hold it for 2 hours. You know, and I just can't figure out why nothing happened. I never saw any tantric deity. And I'm not feeling different. And I'm not aware of any special change in my body. And things aren't happening to me. And I don't know. I'm not getting all these realizations about emptiness. I don't know if this is the best way to do it. I think there must be a problem with this ritual. You know, I think this ritual must be too long or something. You know, this dakye thing is just too long. You know, probably because it's so long, I'm not getting any benefit out of it. Nothing's happening to me. You know, I don't see things. I don't have extraordinary spiritual experiences happening in my life and stuff like that. And I just encourage people to go check their plain old pratimoksha morality. That is where it all comes from. That's the engine that generates all those amazing things. If you want to have amazing spiritual things happen to you, just go back to the pratimoksha and keep it. We're going to cover the basis, which is the ten bad deeds, and we're going to talk about it in detail. That's the seventh class, because that really is the basis. People ask me about the secret teachings, you know, and technically speaking, you have to have an initiation. The technical system of the secret teachings is that you must be initiated in order to start practicing it. You must go through that process of having initiation. Even if your mind is wandering and nothing's happening and it's a long hot day and you're not even there half the time or whatever, you must have that process. You must go through that ritual. But on the other hand, if you keep your pratimoksha nicely, not only does it stop your mental afflictions, you will get to a place where things start happening to you. Extraordinary things start happening to you. Special things start happening to you. And if you don't keep them, it'll never happen. You have to know them and you have to keep them. And you have to take them you really have to take them. The energy of taking a vow not to do something and then not doing it is much, much, much more powerful than just being a good guy by nature. The second one wears off. The second one doesn't have much energy. The second one is not your fault. Don't credit yourself. It came from your past life. Okay? If you generally don't enjoy killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, etc., if you consider yourself a good person, it's not because of any extraordinary effort you've made in this life. You've always been that way. You know, it's been part of your character. If you want to improve on it, you have to make conscious effort. It's very interesting. If you really want to get better, it's going to take work. Whatever you have in you now that's good was not your... You can't take credit for it, okay? It was almost certainly your past life. It wasn't like you had to work over and over, day to day, keeping track in your little confession book over and over the good things and bad things you did. You just don't like lying, or you're not attracted to stealing money out of people's pockets or stealing their cars or like that. But that's not uncaused phenomena. That's a cause phenomena. Somebody in the past was a moral person. And that's why you've climbed up the ladder to where you are. It's very easy to fall down. You know, in this life, most people slide down from where they reached. As they get older, they start to lose it. You have to make a conscious effort to progress from where you are now. Whatever morality or ethical feelings you have now, whatever instincts you have, they come from somebody else's work in the past. And you must build on it. You must go on. You can't stay where you are, because to stay where you are is to drop. You know, the karma for doing that wears out as you live your life. And you won't be as ethical in the second half of your life as you were in the first part unless you really make it a project to be an ethical person. And definitely you won't have any amazing spiritual things happen to you if you don't keep them. You know, if you don't progress in your pratimoksha morality, in those ethical code, you won't have those things happen to you. And you'll be one of those very pitiful Western people who says, you know, the Tibetan lamas are flying and I've read about Milarepa and Naropa could take dead fish and throw them in the water and they swim away and I can't do anything, you know. In fact, my life's quite boring. And I do this ritual every morning and I'm getting tired of it. Nothing's going on. I can't figure out what's the problem. I can't even figure out why I can't meditate well. And it all comes down to pratimoksha. So semjashu, in Tibetan they say semjashu. Keep it in mind. This is the way to have all those amazing things happen to you. If you're not happy and if nothing's happening to you, which is a real drag, then keep not examining your ethical life. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Does it mean you cannot reach the highest goals of Buddhism unless you take full ordination? No, it doesn't mean that. Your odds are much better if you take full ordination. Does it mean you cannot reach the highest goals of Buddhism if you don't take full ordination? No. If you take full ordination and keep it in a half-ass way, or if you take lifetime layman's vows and you keep it very strictly, then the second person would have much more amazing realizations. They'd have a much more exciting life, much more things happening. Anybody can take the secret vows. If you're at minimum, you have to be keeping the 10 non-virtues. You have to be keeping away from the 10 non-virtues. You don't even have to be a lifetime layman's vow to keep the secret vows, to have them. That's in the realm of possibility, but I'd say it's like poa. You know, this thing about poa where in the last 5 minutes of your life, you do what you didn't do for the last 45 years, and somehow it's going to work, it's unlikely. It's very unlikely. I mean, your odds of getting somewhere, if you take at least lifetime layman's vows, are infinitely better. If you keep them, and if you take them seriously, infinitely better chances of having wonderful things happen. And the higher you go, the better. You know. On the other hand, if you don't really have the heart for it and you don't understand it, which probably means you don't have enough renunciation and you're not fed up enough yet with your bad thoughts, you shouldn't take ordination vows. You shouldn't take them if you don't think you can keep them. You should wait until you're ready. You know, and that's why Rinpoche is very reluctant to give people vows. You know, it's very bad to break them. It's very bad to give them up. So better to examine yourself. When the time's ready, you'll know it. But you should always have it as a goal in the back of your mind. Okay? Because it is a goal. And it, personally speaking, it's a wonderful, wonderful way to, it's fantastic. And it's liberating. You know, Matthew Ricard, a famous French monk, a good French monk, in Tricycle, they interviewed him, they said, doesn't it feel very constricting to be a monk? He says, are you kidding? I feel like the most free I ever have. And he's kept his vows very nice for like 20 years, so... If you can do it, it's very cool. Yeah.
Oh, it'd be so good to have them.
Yeah, it's just... I think two things you have to say about that, because you see it a lot in the world nowadays. One is that we can't judge the person. We don't know why they did what they did. Maybe it looks like they wanted to get married or something like that. But you can't be sure. There are famous stories, Gantapada, Luipa, from whom we have the main teachings on Chakrasambhara, pretended to give up his vows. In order to do some special things, or, you know, gave the appearance. You have to be very careful. You can't judge the person unless you can read their mind. Buddha said, unless you can read another person's mind, lay off judging them. You can judge the action. You can say, I shouldn't do that action myself. And you shouldn't. Technically speaking, you just lose the vows from your mental stream. But don't forget, you have vow. It's a jisi tsoi padu. In the vow, you say jisi tsoi padu. As long as I live in the presence of the Buddhas, you swear that as long as I live, I will keep these vows. I mean, we didn't really mention that, but don't forget that all of the pratimoksha vows, except for the one-day vow, you swear before the Buddhas to keep it for your whole life until you die. So then to go and give them back would be like you'd be collecting this extraordinary bad deed of lying in front of all the Buddhas. You know, so it's very bad for your mental strength. So we can't judge them, but we wouldn't want to do it ourselves. Okay, all right. Meditate for a few minutes.